Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is coming to you from CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm your host, Erin Hudson. In this edition...
So this is the type of behavior that's being rewarded by these medals. It's just totally, totally unacceptable.
Today, I'm calling for an independent inquiry to my case.
So.
This is the sound of international solidarity.
But first, here are the headlines. Representatives from six Canadian organizations advocating human rights and civil liberties have been testifying before the Standing Committee on Public Safety and National Security in opposition of Bill S-7, the Combating Terrorism Act. The bill would permit persons to be detained for up to 3 days without being charged and permit investigative hearings in which the person is compelled to testify. To be subject to Bill S-7, a person would have to be suspected or alleged to have committed a crime related to a terrorism offense or associated with a suspect. The six Canadian organizations opposing the bill feel the provisions do not comply with the Canadian Charter of Human Rights and Civil Liberties, the spirit of due process, and the right against self-incrimination. The groups say the Canadian Criminal Code has proven to be effective and Bill S-7 is not necessary for effective law enforcement against terrorism. The bill is currently entering the final stage of being approved in the House of Commons. The six associations opposing the bill are the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, the Canadian Association of University Teachers, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, and the Ligue des Droits et Libertés. In Toronto, Mohamed Majoub is calling for an independent inquiry into his case and for the Government of Canada to drop all charges against him. Majoub has been detained or under house arrest under a security certificate for the past 12 years for allegedly being a terrorism suspect in the eyes of the Canadian government. We now go to a statement read aloud by Majoub on November 27th outside a Toronto courtroom.
Today, I'm calling for an independent inquiry to my case aimed at holding the individual agencies and structure responsible for all those abuses accountable for this action. This inquiry must be free of government control. In the coming months, my supporter and I will reach out of others who have been abused by Canadian security certificate, immigration and national security legislation to build a national campaign for accountability.
Pan-Canada Days of Action are being organized throughout the country for December 9th and 10th in solidarity with the three men under security certificates, Mohamed Majoub, Mohamed Harkat, and Mahmoud Jabala. The Days of Actions will also serve as symbols of solidarity with those detained in immigration detention centers across the country. Mohamed Majoub is scheduled to appear in court the next day, December 11th, for a detention review. And all across Canada, a pan-Canadian weekend of action in solidarity with the people of Gaza was held on the weekend of November 23rd, 24th, and 25th. The Solidarity Weekend was called for by the Canadian Peace Alliance Group. And on November 27th, another global day of action was held to protest pipelines across North America. The day of action was prompted by an incident that occurred in the First Nations Wet'suwet'en territory in British Columbia. Surveyors for the Pacific Trails Pipeline, which is set to run through the community's territories, were evicted from the territory with the presentation of a single eagle feather to symbolize a warning from the Unistuteten people. Their territory is unceded, meaning that no treaties between the Unistuteten people and the Government of Canada have been signed. In a letter from the community spokesperson, addressed to the companies involved in the Pacific Trails Pipeline, the spokesperson warned that any further advances into the territory by the companies or their personnel will be viewed as acts of aggression against the community's sovereignty. The Canadian International Development Agency has a new leader who intends on taking the agency in a new direction. Julian Fantino, who assumed the leadership position several months ago, has publicly stated his intention to have the agency assist in partnering up NGOs with mining companies in developing countries. Mining Watch Canada says the move amounts to a subsidization of Canadian mining companies to assist the companies in dealing with local opposition around their operating sites. And the final report of the Missing Women Commission will be released to the public in mid-December, says the government of British Columbia. The report's release was previously extended to November 30th. The report is almost 1,500 pages and was put together by Commissioner Wally Opal to examine police investigations into murdered and missing women in Vancouver's downtown east side between 1997 and 2002. However, already 3BC human rights groups have released their own report calling the commission a failure. Their report, released November 19th, entitled Blueprint for an Inquiry, outlines the group's criticisms of the commissionary process led by Opal and recommendations for future processes. One of their biggest criticisms, and that of those who held frequent protests against the commission over the past year, was that the commission excluded the voices that were among the most important to include, namely the voices of Aboriginal women, sex workers, and women living in poverty. November 22nd marked an International Day of Action against the commodification of education. We go to Carla Green for this headline from Montreal.
This is the sound of international solidarity in Montreal on Thursday, November 22nd. About 5,000 protesters marched from Square Victoria yesterday as part of an international week of action against the commodification of education. Over 60,000 students in 39 cégeps and universities in Quebec were on strike as part of the week, coordinated by ASSE in Quebec. ASSE is the parent organization of CLASS, which was the main organizing body for the strikes and protests during the student strike last spring. Although the Parti Québécois canceled the tuition hike after their election this fall, the protest felt eerily similar to those last spring during the Printemps Arabe. The chants were mostly the same, calling for free education, condemning the Montreal police, and the spirit was similar. Like last year, the Montreal police were in strong attendance, always under the gaze of at least half a dozen photographers and people videotaping. There was a strong anti-SPVM sentiment and some hostility towards the riot police, but no violence. Although the protest was declared illegal about an hour after it began, it stayed peaceful and no one was arrested. The demo seemed like a celebration of the activism of the Printemps Arabe and of the accomplishments of the student movement. Participants and organizers seemed hopeful about how the student movement's activism might transform into other forms of progressive mobilization. For now, it was almost more like a reunion than anything else, and perhaps a reminder that students have come out of last spring hungry for another movement to mobilize around, to denounce the wrongs of society, and maybe even accomplish something.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes to us from Paul Daniel at Accessible Media Incorporated and looks into the Art Gallery of Ontario's new Frida Kahlo exhibit.
The Art Gallery of Ontario unveiled a new exhibition of works by Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and her husband, Diego Rivera. Frida and Diego, Passion, Politics, and Painting presents more than 100 works by the two artists who shared common interests as well as a tumultuous relationship. Each was the other's greatest supporter. An accident while riding a bus in 1925 had severely injured and continued to affect Frida's health. She began painting while still lying on her back in a body cast. The works reflected on her pain and disability. Paul Daniel, executive producer of Contact, went to the media preview of the exhibition and spoke with Dot Tour, guest curator for the Art Gallery of Ontario, who described the overall collection as well as the influences of feminism and disability on Kahlo's work.
The exhibit has 150 works altogether, over 80 original paintings, over 60 photographs.
And the collection of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, why together as opposed to maybe independently of themselves?
Well, this is drawn from two major Mexican collections, with the Arville Gallery contributing some very significant works by Rivera and Kahlo. And in Mexico, all the collections have both artists. This is before the day of Madonna, who only collects Frida Kahlo. And this was the idea always was, for certainly in the Mexican context, is you don't think of one artist without the other. I think in North America, you've had retrospectives of Rivera. You've had also shows of Frida. It raises different kinds of questions if you put them together.
Turning to her works, her paintings have been recognized for the earlier depictions of feminist expression. Could you sort of elaborate on that?
I think that feminism is a description of a movement that, of which there are a number of waves. The first one, actually, the suffragettes. So that would be about the time Frida's a young girl, and Frida actually cuts her hair short. She is she's a Mexican version of a flapper. She flaunts social conventions. She's very liberal. And I think that's very appealing for other generations of women who adopt a kind of feminism. What Frida represents is a woman, and quite unique at her time. So there are other women artists who are doing that, more in the photography world, who charted a kind of personal reflection of their identity. And that becomes very important for feminism in the 70s and 80s, because the slogan is the personal is political.
And how would you describe her painting style?
Small.
In what way small?
Frida Kahlo's painting style is modeled after a number of traditions, popular cultural traditions within Mexico that date all the way back to the colonial period and are still going on today. Small paintings, often done on tin, that represent very personal things in people's lives. In Mexico, they're called retablos. And her style on another level is, what's interesting about, if you study Frida Kahlo, is she also has a contemporary feel. She paints a lot from photographs, which is what people wouldn't necessarily think of. She's self-taught. She's not academically trained the way Rivera is. They are very distinct styles.
Now, we talk about Rivera. This relationship they had was, to put it mildly, tempestuous. What was the attraction that these two had?
I have to say, I truly believe they were soulmates. They were meant for each other. They were both highly intelligent. Their sense of humor, they shared a joie de vivre. They were deeply intellectual. They shared a passion for politics. And I think that was their political convictions over everything. I think it's hard to remember, or hard to imagine now, and I know that from teaching generations of students, is that it does bond you when you go out and you fight fascism and you go to demonstrations and you're involved with you're watching the Spanish Civil War and you're on the Republican side, and these are life and death matters, and that creates tremendous bonds between people, and this was a bond that they shared their whole life.
What impact does the disability have on her? She was in a streetcar accident at the age of 18. She suffered polio. She had, I think, spinal bifida.
Yeah, that's what they said.
So what impact did disability have on her?
For me, one of the reasons that Frida is so admired is because she had an indomitable will. She persevered despite her disability. She started to paint because she was in bed and she couldn't move. But she wasn't painting her disability. She was painting in spite of her disability. It became one of her themes and something that she represented in a very unique and original way. But I do think we have to understand she should never have lived after that accident. It must have been sheer will. Most people would have given up. She was immobilized for months at a time. Medicine was quite a bit less advanced than it is now. She had 32 back operations. She lived in chronic pain. The painting didn't resolve that chronic pain. The painting was something she willed herself to do despite the chronic pain.
The exhibition runs until January 20th, 2013. The full interview can be heard at ami.ca. This is Catherine McDonald for AMI Audio. You can call me anytime
of the day. The Diamond Jubilee Medals were created to celebrate the 60th anniversary of Queen Elizabeth's ascension to the throne as Queen of Canada. The ceremonial and governmental duties of the Queen are delegated to Governor General, currently David Johnston. To mark the anniversary, the government presented 60,000 medals for significant services or achievements to Canadians. For our next feature, we hear from Joyce Arthur, the president of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, on why the coalition is taking issue with the awarding of two Jubilee medals.
These medals were given to two active anti-abortion protesters who basically spend their lives illegally in front of abortion. They're purposely violating court injunctions that prohibit protesters outside of the clinics in order to protect the safety and privacy of staff and patients. So they're basically harassing women, and in some cases, in the case of the protesters, by the way, are Mary Wagner and Linda Gibbons. Mary Wagner was in jail at the time the awards were given out, and she's been in and out of jail for years, and she's had several arrests back in between 99 and 2001 out here in B.C. She's from B.C., and she also was violating the bubble zone outside of the couple of clinics that we have here. And she's also known to illegally invade clinics. She's done that in B.C., and she did that. That's why she's in jail now. She invaded a clinic in Toronto in August. She basically barged her way into the waiting room, really upsetting the patients, making them cry. The staff had to evacuate the waiting room, barricade themselves, in a hallway, and she was trying to, push open the door and everything. It was awful. It was very frightening for the staff and patients. And so this is the type of behavior that's being rewarded by these medals. It's just totally, totally unacceptable. And then only 1 week after the medals were awarded, the other protester, Linda Gibbons, was arrested again for protesting in front of one of the clinics in Morgenthaler, the Morgenthaler Clinic, I believe it was, for violating their court injunction. So we think it's not just inappropriate that these medals are given out. It's really sends the wrong message about validating and encouraging crime, and possibly even inciting crime. Suddenly it's okay to break the law and protest outside of abortion clinics and harass and scare women. I mean, it's just crazy. It's outrageous. It's totally unacceptable. And, this is the danger. If you just give carte blanche to any MP or any community group to nominate whoever they want, you're going to get some very, very bad picks. And that's why it's important that the Governor General step in now to retract these medals and maybe go back and look at some of the other medals that have been awarded, too. So we alerted all our members and supporters and encouraged them to write letters to the Governor General, protest letters. And we also, of course, wrote a letter ourselves to both the Governor General and to Harper, demanding that they retract the medals. Subsequent to that, we also wrote a letter to the Queen, informing her of the whole issue and explaining that we thought this sullied her name and her reputation, and inviting her to get involved and ask the Governor General to get the medals back.
And have you received any sort of response from the letters that you wrote to any of the parties that you wrote to?
We've received no response from Harper or the Queen yet. I doubt she's got our letter yet, because we had to send it in snail mail. But we did get a response from the Governor General's office just saying that they'd received our correspondence. They're looking at concerns, and we'll get a more detailed response in like 2 or 3 weeks or something. So we'll have to wait and see. But I'm certainly not going to let this rest or accept a form letter in response or something like that. We really need to fix the situation. It just can't stand the way it is. I mean, it's so hypocritical, too. The Harper government is supposedly, tough on crime, and they're building all these prisons and so on, and yet here they are turning around rewarding crime, I guess when it fits their ideology, their anti-choice ideology, but it's totally hypocritical, and it's just not acceptable. It's such a cut-and-dry situation where, these medals are obviously very inappropriate the way that they were awarded, so we're hoping that the Governor General will do something about it. And it was difficult actually to find out, well, who's really accountable, because the whole way that this went down was quite strange, because normally the Governor General would vet the nominations before awarding a medal. And apparently what's happening is that there's 60,000 medals, and anyone can nominate someone, like from the public, and I think those would be vetted by the Governor General. But what the Harper government did was give 30 nominations to each MP, and also a bunch of nominations, presumably 30 again, to 168 community organizations.
Our next feature comes from Annie Banks and examines exploitative workplace practices in Canada and how migrant workers are standing up for their rights in the face of injustice, racism, and discrimination.
In Canada, migrant workers do a large proportion of the labor in the agriculture industry. Multiple tragedies in the last few years have brought to light realities that many community organizers have known for a long time, that of the exploitative situations that many migrant workers experience. Recently, a panel entitled Breaking the Silence spoke about the struggle for migrant workers' rights in relation to food security and agribusiness, and also spoke about the initial socioeconomic conditions that mean workers have to seek work elsewhere in the first place. First, Jose Sicajau speaks about his experience in the temporary foreign worker program. Translation provided by Bill Fairbairn.
El problema más grande que nosotros vimos y yo personalmente vi fue en el año 2003 cuando nosotros estábamos instalando un sistema de riego en la granja. El empleador no le gustó la forma como estaban instalando. Agredió física y verbalmente a un trabajador de origen mexicano.
So there were a lot of abuses that took place during the period, but the one that sort of really stuck out in my mind is in 2006 when I was working on the farm and together with other workers we were installing an irrigation system. And the farmer didn't like the way we were doing it. He grabbed one of the aluminum tubes and hit one of the Mexican workers and physically and verbally assaulted him.
Y nosotros como testigo ocular del hecho somos tres guatemaltecos que estábamos con el mexicano. Firmamos una denuncia en contra del empleador para que respeten los derechos del trabajador. Regresamos a nuestro país y fue causa principal para que nos expulsaran del programa.
So there were three, myself and two other Guatemalan workers, temporary migrant workers, saw what happened. And we eventually signed a document to attest to the fact that he had been attacked and assaulted by the farmer. We ended our contract in October of 2006. We went back to Guatemala, and it was the next year, the beginning of the next year, when we discovered that because we had signed this document, we wouldn't be allowed back into the program.
The farmer that assaulted the worker never did face any recourse, and Jose and his fellow workers remain expelled from the program. As a result, Jose went on to start the organization AGUND, or the Association of Guatemalans United for Our Rights, of which he is the current president. The next speaker, Diego Lorente, works with Project Counseling Service in Guatemala around issues of migration and migrant labor. Here he is talking about the conditions that precipitate some workers entering into migrant worker programs in countries like Canada. With Project Counseling Service, Diego works to build alliances with groups like AGUND and others to organize against exploitation in Guatemala and Canada.
Y esto, por ejemplo, nos permite afirmar que causas de fondo de esta migración forzada, sea a través del trabajo temporal, sea como sea, pues son siempre las mismas, ¿no? Y son pues la violencia social que vive la región, la injusticia, la falta de justicia, la inequidad en la distribución de la riqueza, la corrupción, ¿no? Causas que son comunes en la región y que generan, entre otras consecuencias, la salida forzada de sus poblaciones y en especial de las poblaciones más vulnerables, como son los pueblos indígenas, los niños y las mujeres.
The root causes that lead people to leave the country in different circumstances, whether through the temporary migrant worker programs or in other ways, are the same. We're talking about a situation of great social violence in the region. We're talking about injustice, great inequalities, a lack of an inequitable distribution of the wealth of the region, corruption. And increasingly, the people who are most vulnerable are indigenous people, children, and women.
Lo vemos en los países, en el país de destino, en este caso en Canadá, ¿no? Donde el gobierno trata de aprovecharse de estas personas por ser una mano de obra barata para mejorar económicamente sin dar ningún derecho a estas personas.
We can see how the workers who come up here are exploited in Canada because the Canadian government welcomes them as cheap labor force, but doesn't want to give them the same rights that other people have in the country.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. 2012 is the International Year of the Cooperative, And in honor of that, the NCRA and cooperative community radio stations have joined forces to produce a year-long project aimed at raising awareness about community radio, cooperatives, and cooperative community radio in Canada. We go to the first of five audio documentaries produced as part of the Sounds Cooperative project.
In 2012, the world is celebrating the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives and delivering the message that co-op enterprises build a better world. With more than a billion co-op and credit union members, the international co-op movement is a powerful global force that builds local economies, provides meaningful work, and applies the value of working together to meet our economic, social, and cultural needs. In Canada, the Sounds Cooperative Project is promoting co-op values and successes through a series of radio documentaries produced by co-op radio stations across the country. This series explores Canadian co-op history and links the community radio sector to the broader co-op movement by highlighting shared principles and exploring the diversity of co-ops across the country. The Sounds Co-op Project is a collaboration between the National Campus and Community Radio Association and Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. This program is one of a five-part series. The entire series is archived at soundscooperative.coop.
Cooperation is at least as instinctive to human beings as competition. Thus, people around the world have supported co-ops naturally and easily, often without thinking about them very much. Those words were written by Ian McPherson in his book, A Century of Cooperation. Welcome to the Sounds Cooperative Project, Episode 1, The History of Cooperatives in Canada. I'm Bill Metcalf, and I produced this episode of the series at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC in the spring of 2012.
For more information about the Sounds Cooperative Project or to listen to the full audio documentary, visit the project website at www.soundscooperative.coop. That's it for this edition of Groundwire from CKUT in Montreal. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Hudson. Music was by Montreal artist Think About Life. Headlines were written by Aaron Hudson. We thank Annie Banks, Paul Daniel, Catherine Fisher, and Frida Warren. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.